So there's this question of, is that going to be enough light? Will it last a day? And then at the end of the day, you're striving, you're seeking, you're hoping it'll last, and then you get to the next day and it still goes. That desperate seeking for just a little more light, that's, I think, what I want to describe, and I want to talk about it over the course of time.
On In Good Faith, we believe that all faith traditions have something to teach us about how God is working in the world and in our lives. So join us as we listen and learn. Welcome to In Good Faith on this special bonus episode that only subscribers are getting to hear. I'm in studio today with our senior producer, Heather Bigley.
Hello.
And we got to speak with Joshua Meyer, an artist from Massachusetts who was in town to help inaugurate a display of his that ties in with Hanukkah.
Yeah, his exhibit is called Eight Approaches, and it's featured at the BYU Museum of Art until mid-January 2025. It's also been featured at the Worcester Art Museum in Massachusetts and in Boston, both Hebrew College and the Museum of Fine Arts.
I learned something really interesting about a way of thinking about God as a creator. I mean, the Bible starts that way, so I knew the concept, but I loved being taught something new or feeling like he opened a little door in my mind to some new thought.
And we're actually going to jump into this interview where Mr. Meyer is talking with us about how he often gets the chance to introduce Jewish audiences to art and artistic audiences to Judaism because of his work.
When I speak to Jews about art, it's a very interesting conversation because not all Jews think about art in the way I think about art, and not all artists think about Judaism the way I think about Judaism. And when I'm speaking to a Jewish audience, I find I'm at an interesting crossroads of bringing people who are deeply enmeshed in a Jewish life into art and people who are interested in art in bringing those people into my understanding of Judaism.
Yeah.
And I stand and speak for myself and where I am in that sort of crossroads or juxtaposing those sort of...
I'm not going to introduce you as Rabbi Joshua Meyer. Okay.
So Meyer... If you do, many people will be confused.
Always interesting to talk to an artist who works in, I think, what I would call a silent medium. It doesn't make any noise that I can hear, but it gets a lot happening. We react to it almost the same, I think, as music, with the color, the shape. Do you see those as completely dissimilar, or do you see the rhythm and everything tying those art forms together?
You know, it's interesting. When I'm in the studio, especially when I'm in the studio alone without a model, I'm almost always listening to music.
Uh-huh.
There's something about having rhythm and music behind me that sort of animates the process and the act of painting. Also, I have a few kids, and one of them's a drummer, so I think a lot about rhythm and how it moves you forward, how it propels you. All of those things are really sort of fundamental to the act of, to any act of making any kind of art and creative endeavor. But certainly for me as a painter, it's almost like a dance. And what you see on the canvas is the accumulation, the souvenir of that experience.
Yeah. And as a side note, as the parent of a drummer, this is how you know you truly love your children, which is if there's a drum set in the home. I'm just saying, it can be in the garage and the whole house will still shake. I'm wondering, before I get into a specific work, when did you pick up the knives? Because this is a technique. Maybe describe this.
Sure. I paint with palette knives. They're not, you know, kitchen knives. They're not steak knives. They're designed for painting. They look a little bit, for anyone who's ever worked with drywall or plaster or even a spatula in the kitchen, they feel kind of like that. They're meant for layering paint. They're meant for scraping or pushing it around. They don't have the delicacy of a paintbrush. When I first came out of school and was trying to figure out who I was as a painter, my paintings were pretty realistic. I was working in a realistic approach. I was painting sometimes people, sometimes fabric and still lives. And the work got to a point for me that I felt it was overly intellectualized. It was a little bit tight. I knew how to make the marks I wanted to make and how to tell the story I wanted to tell. And so it ended up being a little bit more in my head instead of being a physical act. And I knew that it wasn't where I wanted to be in the long term. And so I took a moment and I said, I'm going to start from scratch. And so I got rid of all of my paintbrushes. And I decided to paint only...
Was that scary?
Terrifying. But it also was... I had no choice, right? I had hit a point where I knew something had to give. Something had to be different. And what I wanted was to create a new language, right? I wanted something that... I felt like I was building the vocabulary for myself, that it was intrinsically mine, and that wasn't the world I was living in. I wanted something visceral. I wanted something that would happen quickly. I needed something where the physical act would push back at me because I didn't know how to do it. The funny thing about using the knives is you can't actually make a line. Anyone who's ever made any kind of art, whether it was a drawing in kindergarten or something in graduate school, the line's kind of a fundamental part of visual language, and you can't do that with a knife. The way you make a line with a palette knife is that you put two different colors next to each other. You push one up against the other, and then you push the other one back. And where they meet, that juxtaposition, that's the line, right? You're thinking about how things relate to each other. And so if you don't have your basic tools, you end up having to create new ideas for how paint works, how paint describes things, how it tells the stories that you want to tell. So it put me in this just extraordinary place, like a good place. It was beautiful because I suddenly felt alive in front of the canvas in a way that I hadn't.
I spent some time earlier today, knowing we'd be speaking, standing in front of the eight approaches, those eight panels. And I didn't really know how I would describe it other than there were colors kind of pushing against each other. Sometimes it felt like something was trying to emerge and hadn't quite or maybe had broken through. Have you described what you do in words, or is it just a feeling, an aesthetic that is part of you?
One of the things that the paintings that Eight Approaches does is that it's using the same vocabulary that I was describing to you earlier from those earlier days, except that these paintings now are taking much longer. The paintings now take me months, sometimes years, and we're letting time accumulate. So when you say things were emerging in those paintings, I think what you're seeing is that it's a cycle, it's a heartbeat, the paintings need to be alive. So you are seeing my first thought covered up by my second thought, covered up by my third thought. Then I scraped them all down and started again. You're seeing these buckets of time accumulate. This is not about painting. This is about life. When you have a friend in your life, when you have someone you love in your life, your understanding of them doesn't come and go in that first moment. That's layered over and over with the experiences you've had with that person, the trips you took together, the conversations you had, the times you cried together, the times you fought with each other. Those things are layered, and the paintings have to do the same thing.
You could say the same thing about a person's relationship with God or the divine.
Of course, of course.
Which is really interesting. I haven't heard it put that way, just snapshots over time or events over time.
I just came from the BYU Museum of Art, and we were looking at a Rembrandt painting that's there. It's an extraordinary painting. What's fascinating about the way he paints, when he paints people, is that they're very, very human. He's showing you not an idealized person. He's showing you someone who's real and has flaws. That painting, if that's a painting of Christ, it doesn't feel like a god. It feels like a human, right? Mm-hmm. It feels like someone that you could be walking with in the street. In the Bible, in the Torah, all of the matriarchs and patriarchs, these people who we think of them as paradigms, these are deeply flawed people, right? In my understanding of the Jewish tradition, that's what makes them really exciting, is not that they are perfect and in every way meant to be followed. It's that they're flawed just the way I am. And you can understand them like real humans. And I guess the paintings, I want them to have that same feeling. I want them to be breathing and alive. I want them to have layers of contradictions, multiple different ideas. They should show both that the person I'm depicting has that, but also that I, as the artist, have that, right? I didn't get it right. I got it wrong lots and lots of times, and I left the pieces that I thought added up to something that was worth looking at.
I read you describing that first creative act we hear from in the Torah, the separation of two things into opposites, light and dark. And then this painting has to do with what's often called the Festival of Lights, with Hanukkah. I wonder if you could talk to me about the genesis, not to make a pun, sorry about that, it just happens, of the idea and then you deciding how you would divide that up? Because this was really interesting to me, into the eight panels and what they represent.
In Genesis, the beginning of the Torah, the beginning of the Bible, I love those stories, right? There's actually, it's fascinating that there's not one story of how the world came into being in the Torah. There's two, and they're like in a row, and they're contradictory, and they're complicated, and it starts with that idea of process, which to me, it's really important to me that you see the process, that when you come up to the painting, you understand that there was someone there making that. As an part of the audience, you're implicated in the act of making the painting itself. You see that I'm making choices. So when we learn about God's making the world in the first week of creation, that story is so much about process. It feels just to me like being in the studio. God starts and says, I've got light and I've got dark, and I'm going to divide those up. I'm juxtaposing two ideas. And then what does God do? God steps back like any first-year art student does in their studio. They're like, oh, wait, does that work? And you evaluate, and then you go back in and you build the next thing, and you keep layering one thing on top of another, and then you take a step back and you see if it works or not. And you're building by juxtaposition. You're making art not as a fait accompli. You're making it through a process of evaluation and reevaluation, and it speaks so directly to me as...
I've never thought of artistic evaluation, but the story never goes on to the next step without being said, and God said it was good.
Yeah, exactly.
It got to a place I'm okay with.
Yeah, that to me, when I leave the studio at the end of the day or when I come back the next morning, that's what I do. I just step back and I say, wow, I've been immersed in that. My nose was in the painting and you couldn't see it. And you step back and you want to say, well, what came of that? And that's how you move on to the next day. It's so fundamental. And then like at the end of that creation story, that's where we learn that people are created in the image of God. So to me, this is the way the entire Torah, the entire Bible starts, is that we learn that we're created in the image of God. And to me, the image of God is a creator. I feel like this is the life I'm leading, is following that example of making art through a creative process that I really deeply understand.
Do you see your art as a spiritual practice?
I think it's complicated for someone who is both religious and who is an art maker to figure out where those lines get drawn and how you balance those acts, but absolutely. I think every little bit of it is something that I understand through my Jewish training. If you're a traditional Jew, you don't pray when you feel the muse come to you. You put on your tallit and your tefillin at a prescribed hour of the day, on a prescribed day of the week, and you follow a certain ritual of how you pray. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like going into the studio. I don't go into the studio when suddenly I have an idea for a painting. I go into the studio as soon as my day starts, my children leave the house, I get my tools, I put out new paints if they need to scrape off the dry paints, I set myself up and I get to the task at hand. The idea is that when inspiration strikes you, you're there with the tools to do something about it. If inspiration strikes me and I'm taking a hike through the woods, I'm not going to be able to make art about it. If I know that every day I'm in the right place with the right tools, then if I'm lucky enough that an idea comes and surprises me, that I can react to that in real time with the language that I have available to me, with the means I have as a human being, that's something I've learned from Judaism, right? That's something that I understand, because you don't pray when you feel inspired. You pray when you're expected to pray, and sometimes you're lucky enough that that feels inspired to you as well.
I'm wondering, with eight approaches, eight vertical panels, maybe a foot wide, maybe 3 or 4 feet tall, placed on the wall side by side, and what do they represent to you?
The two things that I've been really focused on in my painting, one of them is light. The other thing is the way time works in art, the way you change from moment to moment or day to day. So I'm interested in those two ideas as sort of a studio practice. And it occurred to me that within a Jewish framework, there's actually a place and a time where those two things really explicitly come together, and that's the holiday of Hanukkah. It's called the Festival of Lights. And in a house, you have a menorah, which has eight lights, eight candles on it, or eight little buckets with oil. And every night, you light one more candle. And really, this is a way you are marking time with light. Mm-hmm. And it occurred to me that if I really wanted to explicitly explore how Judaism thinks about change, thinks about time, and thinks about light, this is a perfect sort of structural way to build that. Every painting was built as its own painting, and it was just a question of how it would all come together. It was eight single paintings, and then they got rearranged and moved, and so there's eight paintings in a row. They sort of take the physical form of a Chanukiah, of a Chanukah menorah. If you're approaching this painting and thinking about time and thinking about light, you can then do it from a Jewish point of view, and you can think about why Judaism uses those metaphors and how it does that. So the story of Chanukah, in broad strokes, the Greeks had taken over, the Jews are not living their best lives, there's a battle, the synagogue, the temple is destroyed and devastated, and the Maccabees fight back, and they reclaim the temple in Jerusalem, and what do they do then? They rededicate it. And that's what mm-hmm. the word Chanukah means, is dedication. And how do they do it? They do it with light. As the story comes to us, is that they found one container of oil, just enough oil to relight the menorah. And miraculously, it lasted for 8 days. So there's this question of, is that going to be enough light? Will it last a day?
Yes.
And then at the end of the day, you're striving, you're seeking, you're hoping it'll last, and then you get to the next day, and it still goes. That desperate seeking for just a little more light, that's, I think, what I want to describe, and I want to talk about it over the course of time and how that creates an approach. You go back and forth to the painting, and you have to illuminate the painting on your own as a viewer.
What I read at the exhibit is that because there is a ninth candle that's used to light the others, that the person standing before them sort of becomes that the paintings come alive as you see them. And what I want to ask you is tying that together with the whole title of Eight Approaches. I could think, oh, eight different people's experience, but it feels like it's eight approaches, as you say, over at different times, maybe with the same person.
So having the eight panels kind of takes on it looks a little bit like film stills. It looks a little bit like comic book panels. You can read it. It looks a little bit like a triptych, right? Mm-hmm. There's an order to the way they can be read, and you can take that as narrative. And I encourage that, and that's part of the approaches.
But I have to inform that myself.
Exactly. You will be the shamash, that ninth candle that will mm-hmm. go in, and you will overlay what you bring to it onto those paintings. Mm-hmm. I don't want to tell you what I'm thinking about. If I tell you that it means this one thing, then I've closed the painting off for you as a viewer. I want it to be open, and I want it to be living, and I want it to be alive. And the only way to do that is to put so much information into it that every time you come up to it, it will give you something new back. I didn't come to it with one idea. I came to it with every idea I had for the course of a year or two as I painted it. And I put all of that in there. When I was in the studio, there were some terrible anti-Semitic things that happened in the world, and I was dealing with those in the studio, and I put some of those into the paintings because that's where I process my world. When I was working on the paintings, I had wonderful things happen to me, good things in my life with my friends, my family. Those are in those paintings too. I want the juxtapositions in those paintings to give you enough of a head start that you can meet them in the middle and that they're going to pull your story out of you. The eight approaches, it really has to be an open-ended story.
I'm wondering a little bit about your family of origin, and was religious practice part of that?
You know, I grew up in a fairly traditional family. I went to a Jewish day school, and so I had a lot of nurturing Jewish community as mm-hmm. a kid, and different parts of my family were more observant or less observant, and there were lots of different models out there for me. As I became an adult, I had to figure out what kind of community I wanted to build for myself.
As far as feeling like, are your artistic gifts in the sense that maybe they were given to you with a divine source?
Yeah, I don't like to frame it as divinely given gifts. What I do think is that everyone has their own language, right? The thing that every artist even has, like, a different way of describing things. Some things you're more facile with and some things are more difficult for you. It's some tools that you have to then figure out what to do with. Mm-hmm. The thing that I want to hold on to is sort of the interconnectedness of everything, right? It's miraculous that everything exists in the way it does. And I think that everyone has some sort of magical spark in them to find their voice and to figure out what to do with it. It's not that I deny that there's a sort of a
right
anything else to it, but I just don't frame it that way.
And calling it a language is so interesting because it is a way you're communicating something to other people. Do you think of your own work differently after it's gone through somebody else's life's filter and they're expressing what they're experiencing from it?
I always make the paintings with the intention of having them out there in the world. In the same way you raise children, you don't expect them to stay in your house for their entire life, right? You have the hopes that they're going to become fully fledged individuals. The same way we described your approach to eight approaches, right? The way you are the shamash, you're the ninth candle that makes the painting come alive. If it doesn't go out into the world, if it sits in the corner of my studio wrapped in plastic, it doesn't have an ability to thrive. It really comes alive when it meets a viewer. And I want the painting to meet you halfway, and I want you to meet the painting halfway, and a painting has to be alive.
Finally, what should I ask you about art or spirituality, any intersection that you feel there that I don't know to ask?
I think what I would just say is to remain curious, right? Uh-huh. I think every painting from early Renaissance paintings to contemporary works, that whichever one is the most confusing and confounding to you, I think you approach it and you bring curiosity and meet it on its own terms and bring what you have to it. I think that's what I would recommend to anyone who wants to have a deeper understanding of any art.
Many thanks to Joshua Meyer for speaking with us. This episode was produced by Heather Bigley. Our production team also includes Ilya Ebert, Katarina Martinich, and James Sturdivant. Our post-production sound designers are Mark Hansen, Lauren Sandberg, and Ashton Parkinson. In Good Faith is committed to the idea that we all benefit from hearing people of widely varying backgrounds share their personal experience with faith and belief. In fact, we think people with such experience deserve some of our best listening. You could help spread the word about the podcast by leaving a comment or review on YouTube, Spotify, Apple, wherever you get your podcasts. Look for us on social media. We're on Instagram, Facebook, and our YouTube channel is youtube.com/@in-good-faith. In Good Faith is a production of BYU Radio. I'm Stephen Cap Perry. I hope you join us again soon, right here, in Good Faith. Hi, I'm Stephen Cap Perry, host of In Good Faith. Nothing captivates me more than people setting out on an adventure, especially if it's a place I wish I could go to or a subject I wish I knew more about, but I don't live in the right place or I don't have the equipment or the expertise. I'm telling you about a podcast from our BYU Radio family of podcasts, an award-winning podcast called Constant Wonder. With host Marcus Smith, you'll be expanding your horizons on all kinds of discovery. It could be science, it could be art, history, and more. Do you need that feeling of awe and wonder in your life more? I do, and I love it when I see how to experience that by hearing the stories of people who are doing and exploring all of those things that are so interesting to me. Check out the podcast, Constant Wonder.